This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. Our guest this morning is Bill McKibben, author of 10 books, including The End of Nature, The Age of Missing Information, and Enough, Staying Human in an Engineered Age. A former staff writer for The New Yorker, he writes regularly for Harper's, The Atlantic Monthly, and The New York Review of Books, among other publications, and is currently a scholar in residence at Middlebury College. Bill McKibben is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future, published in 2007 by Time Books, an imprint of Henry Holt and Company. We also will hear about the National Day of Climate Action to take place on April 14th. Welcome, Bill.
Hey, it's very good to be here.
It's good to have you here. What led you to write Deep Economy?
Well, I've been working on environmental issues for a long time. In 1989, I wrote The End of Nature, and that was the first book for a general audience about climate change, about global warming. And ever since then, in one way or another, I've been grappling with the reality of that situation, which is that we're going to need to make pretty profound changes in a lot of ways, how we live. And I think eventually this led me to think more systematically about our economic life than I had in the past, and to wonder whether the basic assumption that guides that economic life, that more is better, is really a notion we can continue to follow quite as blindly as we have been for the last 50 years. And the book is an effort to argue that more and better are no longer synonymous, if they ever were, and that we're, in a sense, going to have to choose between an infinite growth economy and, in my mind, the much more benign, more localized economies that focus less on consumption and more on building durable, tightly knit, and rewarding local communities.
What do you see as the fundamental problem with the idea that prosperity is based on economic growth, that more is better?
I think there's two problems. One is that ecologically it's becoming difficult to maintain the idea that we can keep doing this. Climate change is happening so quickly, and its cure is so powerful, i.e., that we're going to need to bring down very quickly our use of fossil fuel, that it seems unlikely that the kind of fast growth economy that we've built can deal with that situation. The second reason, maybe more interesting, is that our assumption that growth is making us happier is being called into question by all kinds of new data, which indicates, in fact, if anything, the reverse, that for the last 50 years, even as Americans have gotten startlingly richer, and we have three times the material quality of life that we did in, say, 1950, the number of Americans who are actually willing to say that their lives are very happy has gone steadily down. Not much more than a quarter of our countrymen will make that claim today, which is a pretty discouraging thought, considering all the, if nothing else, all the environmental trauma that that tripling of our standard of living has caused.
Would you comment on the observation you made in your book that both the left and the right seem to buy into the economic growth model?
Well, pretty much all our decision-making in Washington and in Olympia for, you know, the last long time has been based on the idea that what makes the economy larger is what we should do. From the right, people talk a lot about, you know, tax cuts and things like that. But on the left, people often, too, think that we can get rid of the very real and bad problem of inequality and of poverty in our society by growing the economy larger. That doesn't seem to be working. For the last 20 years, inequality has increased dramatically, even as the economy has expanded in size. And, you know, politicians like this answer because it's painless. It doesn't involve having to make choices. It sort of works automatically. But I think we need to think more deeply than that now.
What problems does the current Western growth model pose for the developing world?
Well, the biggest problem is that they can't emulate us. There's not enough stuff or enough atmosphere to allow them to do it. I've spent a lot of time in China in the last couple of years doing reporting for National Geographic and Harper's and things. It's very interesting and profound, moving to be there now and see that kind of runaway, dynamic, exciting growth. 10% a year the Chinese economy grows. If that continues for another 30 years, they'll be as rich as we are. If they consume the way that we do, well, there are 800 million automobiles on this planet right now. If the Chinese owned them in the same profusion as Americans, they'd add 1.1 billion cars to the planet themselves. Then you'd get the Indians and everybody behind them. That's not possible. There's not enough stuff to produce them, nor enough atmosphere to soak up the effluents, not to mention enough oil to run them on. Should the Chinese prosper to the point where they can all adopt our diet, they'd use themselves about two-thirds of the world's grain harvest just to feed themselves. Given that this can't work, we need to start thinking about what can, both here and in other places. Because if we continue to set the example that we set, it stands to reason that people around the world will try to emulate it, if only because our biggest exports now are motion pictures and television programs, our kind of advertisements for a good life, unattainable even by many in America and definitely by the rest of the world.
You've alluded to this already, but what is a better path than economic growth for a durable future? How should we change direction?
Well, I think we're going to need to think about shortening supply lines that we've been lengthening for the last 100 years. So, for instance, I mean, the most obvious example is with food. That's where we've sort of begun. The fastest growing part of the food economy are local farmers' markets. Seattle is famous for some of its farmers' markets and a wonderful network. You know, some of them attracting 10,000 shoppers on a Saturday. That's good for two reasons. One, it's much more energy efficient, much more sustainable than our current practice of shipping food enormous distances. The average bite of food in this country has traveled 2,000 miles before it reaches your lips. But it's also good because those kind of markets build a different sort of community than the industrialized shopping experience we've mostly subscribed to now. People who go to farmers markets, a recent study found, have about 10 times as many conversations on average as people at the supermarket. That's an interesting statistic. It suggests that they're not just about a new way of ingesting calories. They're about a different way of participating in a community.
You spent some time eating locally yourself. Could you share with us some of the insights you got from that experience?
And I live in the mountains of Vermont up near the Canadian border. Not quite as benign a growing season as you have here. But we decided one winter, my family and I, a couple of years ago, to see if we could make it through the whole winter from October to May, just eating food from our local valley. And we did just fine. We actually ate extremely well. We didn't have lettuce and tomatoes. We did have all the root vegetables, and we did have all kinds of good, you know, meat and dairy and grain. We even had our local brewery brewing beer from wheat grown down in our valley. So we made it through in style, eating well. We also, by the end of the year, had all kinds of new friends among the farmers and small-scale food processors who we'd come to know and depend on over the course of that winter.
You've been talking about the benefits of eating local food. Could you also comment on the advantages of more locally produced energy when both the costs and the benefits are local?
Our energy system at the moment works much like our food system. We have a vast centralized system with a few huge power plants or whatever, and a few huge energy suppliers like ExxonMobil. That has many drawbacks, including the dependence on fossil fuel that's causing climate change. It's possible to imagine, indeed, we begin to see that it's possible to replace that with an energy system that works more like the internet works, where people both put in and take out. I have solar panels on the roof of my home in Vermont, They're tied into the electric grid. When the sun shines, our house is a small utility. The electric meter spins the wrong way. We send electrons down the line to power my neighbor's refrigerator. When the cloud passes over, we draw power from the grid like everyone else. That kind of distributed energy system probably in the long run will be more durable and resilient than the very vulnerable and fragile power system that we've built in this country now. And it's, I think, exciting to imagine moving in that direction. I was pleased to see on the front page of the Seattle Times the other day the story about new housing developments going in places like Issaquah with net zero energy homes built exactly on this model.
I'm Diane Horn, and we are speaking with Bill McKibben, author of Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future. In your book, you speak about the balance between individualism and community. How does the proper balance between individualism and community affect whether we have a durable future?
We've allowed our society to become almost hyper-individualistic, I think you could say. That's what happens in a very advanced consumer society, and we're by far the most advanced one of those that there's ever been. Years ago, I did an interesting book called The Age of Missing Information, which I went and found the largest cable TV system in the world, which had, at the time, 100 channels, and I got people to tape for me everything that came over them for 24 hours. So I had 2,400 hours worth of videotape, took it home for a year and watched it. A lot of lessons kind of came through that, all of that. But the most important one, the kind of message that flowed all the time through that cable was, you know, you're the most important thing on Earth. You're the center of the universe. That hyper-individualistic idea, which we've taken to calling human nature, is actually a kind of new idea for human beings. Most people in most places still have something else. Family, tribe, community, relationship with the divine, something close to the core of their identity that allows them to not be the center of everything and to limit their behavior a little bit. We don't have that so much. And so we see a kind of lifestyle that increasingly turns almost to farce. I don't know if you saw the story, Diane, in the New York Times last week about how the new trend in high-end homes is for dual master bedrooms because husbands and wives find it increasingly difficult to share the same bedroom. One of them might snore or pull on the covers or something, and that's no longer acceptable, and hence we're building even bigger homes than we were before. There's probably no way to begin to cure some of the energy trouble that we find ourselves in, some of the environmental trouble, unless we can shift a little bit toward a more community-oriented approach. You can see the fruits of that in places like Western Europe. Your average Western European has made a choice more in the direction of community. They've paid somewhat more taxes so that they can, say, support nice cities that draw people in, so that they can afford national health insurance and education for people, so that they can build public transit. The results of those are interesting. For one, Europeans use half as much energy per capita as Americans do. Half is a big number. It gets us closer toward solving global warming than most of the kind of technological fixes that people have suggested. Also, Europeans haven't seen the same declines in satisfaction and in happiness that have marked the American experience. They've been consistently higher than we have, partly because people aren't feeling the same kind of loss of social context and community that plagues Americans.
Could you comment on potential synergies between building community and fighting global warming?
Well, public transportation probably is a good example. Americans burn ungodly amounts of fossil fuel moving themselves around one at a time. You couldn't design a more inefficient system, and yet it's very difficult for us to break out of it, partly because we haven't built the good public transit systems, and partly because we're so used to the idea that we need to go where we want at exactly the second that we want to go there and not wait the 5 minutes or 20 minutes or whatever for the train or the bus so that we can move more en masse. Food is another. you know, the community effort required to make a farmer's market results in using something like 10 times less energy to feed ourselves than the long-distance takeout model that we normally employ. Those are the kind of changes that could really begin to add up in this fight against climate change, especially if we also get some of the technological change that is coming.
Could you give some examples of success stories of citizens building toward more local economies and better communities?
Sure. Let's continue talking about food for a minute. In Vermont, where I live, in our biggest city, Burlington, about 10 years ago, a bunch of people, a nonprofit, took over what was really the old city dump in a place called the Intervale. About 120 acres there of land. They divided it up into about 10 farms, and they leased it to these 10 small farms, who then began growing and selling food. Now, about 10% of the fresh food that the city of Burlington eats comes from that one plot of land. That's pretty impressive. It gives you a sense that it's not impossible to imagine a much more localized food system. In fact, I've seen it on a much larger scale doing reporting for Harper's Magazine in Cuba, which is a very, you know, problematic and interesting place in all kinds of ways. The reason I went there was because Cuba is really the only country in the world to really experience peak oil. When the Soviet Union collapsed, so went its energy and its food supply, most of which was coming from Eastern Europe. They had no fertilizer and they had no pesticides because of our embargo. And so they set to work building a de facto organic, largely urban agriculture, very different from what they'd done before. It took a few years. At the beginning, without the outside support they were used to, the average Cuban went from 3,000 calories a day down to 1,700. People were losing weight fast. It was a tough place. They're back up to 3,000 calories a day now, and partly it's because every vacant lot in Havana and every other city is a farm, and farming is a high-prestige occupation. It pays as much or more as being a doctor does in Cuba. And if you think about it, that makes a certain amount of sense because it's probably as important an occupation.
What is the best size for a community that has the ability to function more locally?
I think that there's no one size for which we're aiming and that we're not trying to create communities that are all local. We need people to be able to work at many scales. And one of the things that makes that easier to imagine now is the advent of the internet. Once upon a time, local communities were also parochial, closed in, often sort of insulated from outside ideas, likely to marinate in their own prejudices. That's much less true now that we have an easy, low-cost, low-energy way, the internet, to exchange ideas across the country and across the globe. And that's, you know, that's sort of the story of this climate action that we're working on, in fact, a perfect example of how to do things both locally and nationally at the same time.
The mass production emphasized by our current economic system is often claimed to be more efficient. Could you comment on the efficiency of mass production compared to smaller ventures?
Efficiency in many of the things we do is tied to ignoring what an economist would call the externalities, the real costs that come from burning, say, the oil involved in growing and transporting industrial food around the country. If you factor in those externalities, including the fact that they're degrading the planet at a terrifying clip, then that efficiency becomes considerably less impressive. And you begin to see that we might be far better off with a few more people back on the farm, say, and a little more attention instead of a little more oil, which has been our answer for the last 100 years.
Could you also give some success stories of communities that are working toward more decentralized power, some examples of local energy networks?
Sure. There's lots of places around the country where wind power has people have started to employ at a municipal level and even a community scale. And for me, that's far more interesting than the kind of off-the-grid lifestyle that people have talked about in years past. it was very noble, you know, that was the leading edge of kind of renewable things, people who built a solar system for their house or a windmill for their house. And it was good, and we should be thankful for those people pioneering these technologies. But in the end, I think it's even more interesting to be tied into a grid, a kind of literal energy community, as it were, and to be depending on other people in the same way that, in a sense, it's more interesting to be tied into a farmer's market grid than it is to have to grow every calorie that you eat yourself. These are old kinds of organization coming back into prominence now.
Well, you've been alluding to all of this, but what does a durable future look like? Could you paint a picture of what you would envision as an ideal future that would be durable?
Smaller in scale, more interested in belonging than in belongings, more interested in social connection than in endlessly increasing the quantity of stuff that we produce, and more interested in resilience than in expansion, i.e. in communities that can survive some of the difficult times that are coming no matter what we do. I mean, a lot of global warming is going to happen even if we do everything we should do from here on in. It's going to require stronger communities than we've got in order to withstand them. And you get some sense of that by looking, say, at how fragile communities in places like New Orleans turned out to be in the wake of real shock to the system.
What do you see as the best steps to come to this more durable future that has the features you just described?
Well, one of the things we got to do is start, I mean, some of it will happen automatically if we start changing the cost of energy. That's probably the most important legislative action that we can take. And if we take it, then it will start to be less likely that we want to send food 2,000 miles, you know, less likely that we want to depend on oil and coal as our main sources of fuel. All those things will become less likely and their local alternatives more possible. I think that's going to be the biggest driver that gets us going in the direction we need to go.
Could you now spend a few minutes and tell us about the April 14th National Day of Climate Action, the call to action on climate change, of which you are a key organizer?
Sure. This feeds in directly to what we were just talking about, the price of energy and things. You know, very little has been done for the last 20 years in this country to address this global warming crisis. Essentially nothing, at least in Washington. So earlier this year, a few of us, myself and six college students at Middlebury College in Vermont, where I teach, launched a website called stepitup07.org. And from that website, we tried to encourage people to hold rallies around the country on April 14th, the first big public outcry about climate change, demanding that Congress take real action to reduce global warming gases 80% by 2050. We didn't have any idea how it would succeed. We had no money and no organization. And as I say, the largest rally ever held in this country about climate change was barely 1,000 people, one that we organized last summer in Vermont. We hoped we might be able to organize maybe 100 or 150 of these rallies by April 14th, but instead people have taken up this challenge and run with it in truly marvelous ways. By late March, we were over 1,000 of these rallies. Clearly, it's going to be the largest grassroots environmental protest since Earth Day 1970, and people are coming up with incredibly creative ways to participate. You know, scuba divers holding underwater rallies off the endangered coral reefs in the Florida Keys, or people crowding into Lower Manhattan in blue T-shirts to form a sea of people to show where the new tide line will be once the sea level starts to rise. Or here in Seattle, a very good organizing going on. In fact, there's even a local website here, stepitupseattle.org, that has details about what will be going on. I think the main gathering place will be Occidental Park at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on April 14th. And I think it's going to be a very, very successful and powerful day.
What do you hope the National Day of Climate Action will accomplish?
I hope it will accomplish the task of convincing our legislators in Washington that we need action and ambitious, dramatic action, not token half measures, but something large enough to meet the challenge that the scientists have given us, a real reversal of our energy system in short order so that we have some hope of ameliorating climate change short of all-out catastrophe.
Do you have specific proposals?
The main goal is this 80% reduction by 2050, which is embodied in a piece of legislation introduced by California Senator Boxer and by our own Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. It was seen as a kind of far-fetched idea even 6 months ago, but it's gaining co-sponsors fast. John Edwards has announced his support for that legislation as part of his presidential campaign. We're very encouraged by the speed with which things are beginning to shift.
How do you see this affecting the presidential race in 2008?
We hope that this becomes the standard which any candidate who wants to be taken seriously about climate has to meet, because if they don't, then we have very little chance the first few months of 2009, when the Bush administration is finally gone, is going to be probably our best and maybe final bite at this apple of trying to do something about this.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I'd like to ask people to join us on April 14th, stepitup07.org and stepitupseattle.org. It's going to be a remarkable day. It's the short-term answer to the problem for which deep economy is an effort at a longer-term answer.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Bill.
Thank you, Diane.
We have just been speaking with Bill McKibben, author of Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future, published in 2007 by Times Books, an imprint of Henry Holt & Company. For more information about Deep Economy, check on the web at www.billmckibben.com. Again, that's billmckibben.com. And for information about the April 14th National Day of Climate Action, go to www.stepitup2007.org. Again, that's www.stepitup2007.org. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, selected sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on podcasting, and scroll down to Mind Over Matters sustainability segment. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week.